Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. Welcome to History of the Talmud, Part 6. So you'll see as we go farther and farther into the future, or the past, or back to the future, I don't know how you want to call it, so we get more and more information. That's because they weren't allowed to write down things, and we'll do a whole shiur on that when we get up to the publication of the Mishnah. We'll do a whole shiur on why there's so little information before these points in time. It's because they weren't allowed to write anything down. There was a clear prohibition in the Torah, a biblical prohibition, that Dvarim Sheba Baal Peh, that things that were originally transferred or transmitted orally had to remain oral. And basically until there was a massive decision that said that because of Esla Soslashem, because the time was coming and things were getting a little bit heady for the Jewish people, they were recognizing that they were heading for a long exile, so they felt, they realized that they had no choice but to write things down. So as we go farther and farther into history, or closer to us, we have more and more information because they started to write more and more things down and record more and more. But until the destruction of the Second Temple, they were very much minimalist. And even after that, they were generally minimalist until the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So what period of time are we into now? We're into the period of time, let's say, 60 CE until 70 CE, we're going to be focusing on now. What's going on? We've already seen that Hillel took leadership at a time of great upheaval within the Jewish people. You have Roman influence becoming more and more intense. You have the breakdown of traditional religious and political leadership bodies. The bureaucracy of Jewish leadership and halacha, which were one, are breaking down themselves. And you've created new institutions. You've created kind of this singular type of leader, this Gadol Hador, which we said was symbolized by the name Rabban, right? This new name that all of a sudden comes up. No one was ever called Rabbi before that. And then all of a sudden you have the invention of the Rabban, and the Rabban is going to have a cadre of scholars around him called each one with the name Rabbi. And all of a sudden you're going to have this new type of leadership that's being created. What's going on? We spoke about, just to go through Hillel's family of leadership again, we have Hillel, we have Shimon, the son of Hillel, who does very little, right? He's known basically as Shimon Beno, Shimon his son. The reason for that is that Hillel's tenure seems to be exceptionally long. Hillel lived to a ripe old age, that by the time Hillel passed away and gave it over to his son, so Hillel's grandson was already distinguishing himself as a great leader, and that's how we saw what we called Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, Gamliel the First, Gamliel the Elder, who we said takes on making many takanot, trying to retain some semblance of halachic leadership, working outside the normative system. We see him making decisions kind of on his own, on his little platform, etc. going on. This is already, as we're heading into 40, 50 CE. And then you have Rabban Gamliel's son, Shimon ben Gamliel, who, except for a scant quote in Pirkei Avos, Shimon ben Gamliel, who we'll call Shimon the Second, or if we were doing Shimon ben Gamliel, we would do him Shimon ben Gamliel the First. But Shimon, the son of Gamliel the Elder, we hear very little from him in Talmudic sources. And in traditional rabbinic sources, we hear very, very little about him. Why is that? So the Gemara and the rabbinic literature give very little indication as to why. Josephus sheds a little bit of light on it. Josephus makes the claim, and again, every claim Josephus makes. So sometimes, I don't know what the rules are. You'd have to ask a historian, not a Talmud teacher. You'd have to ask a historian what the rules are for when we do and we don't believe Josephus, I think the reigning expert is one of my teachers, but I took him for classics, not for Josephus, is Dr. Louis Feldman, and he has a whole article on it in a book that's sitting on my desk to read. So one of these days when I get to reading it, I'll be able to tell you when we do and we don't trust Josephus. But I will tell you this, is that Josephus makes the claim that Shimon ben Gamliel was a little bit on the fence about the revolt against Rome that began in the 60s, like literally the 60s, right? The revolt against Rome that began in the 60s. 60s are always a time of revolution, right? Is that the way it goes? So he was on the fence, and then he decides to join the revolt, and he is killed in the process of the revolt, which leaves the situation a little bit odd, because remember, Hillel is a descendant of David HaMelech. If there's going to be a leader of the Jewish people, it's going to come, he's going to come from Hillel's family. But if you think you're going to be losing, if you believe that you're going to be losing the war, as many members of the rabbinical class thought, and we're going to discuss where the rabbinical class or the mainstream leadership of the Jewish people, whose side they were backing, and I think it'll become clear as we read through the stories. So they have no choice, and it seems like they make the decision to hide Rabban Gamliel. And he is not going to reveal himself, at least in rabbinic sources, until, let's say, late 80s CE. That's when he's going to basically have his big coming out party, and quite a party it is. I'm going to have to devote 2 to 3 shiurim just to Rabban Gamliel's Yavne, after we do probably 2 shiurim on Rav Yochanan, because there's pre-destruction Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, and there's post-destruction Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. So let's start with what's going on. You have here a burgeoning revolution. People who are unhappy living under Roman rule, there are plenty of reasons to be unhappy for being under Roman rule. One is, and this is something that's pointed out by Gaffney, Jews just to this day never like being ruled by other people, particularly in their country. For the most part, for the turn of the millennium, shall we say, most nations which were under the Roman Empire, it was not yet the Holy Roman Empire, I don't think yet, most nations which were under the Roman Empire were fairly content being under the Roman Empire. That's because, in general, Rome had benevolent despots. They tended to rule quite fairly, unless they were fighting a significant war. They tended not to levy too hard of taxes, but for some reason they levied the Jews some heavy taxes. Why? So it's the chicken or the egg. Did they levy the taxes and therefore the Jews, there was a great upheaval, or was there upheaval and therefore they levied heavier taxes to try to control them? So it's hard to say which, but we'll put it this way. The Jews were never, ever, ever happy with someone else ruling them, particularly inside their country. It never sat well with them. You want to call it the messianic ideal, you want to call it the spiritual ideal, you want to call it just, Jews have a problem with authority, but throughout there, and it's always the same claim, only God rules over the Jewish people. That was the claim. Only God rules over the Jewish people. It's not something we're necessarily going to argue with. We certainly agree that only God rules over the Jewish people, but that's what's going to happen also, and you're going to see it happen again. Because even after 70 CE, you would think, you got your temple destroyed, you got your Torah is kicked all over the place by the Romans. You had these large massacres. The Romans are going to levy heavy taxes on you to keep you down. You finally have some semblance of, self-rule, some sort of comfort. You got these great leaders, exceptional leaders who are taking like real bold steps for the Jewish people, whether it be Rabbi Akiva, Rabban Gamliel. You have Rabbi Meir on the rise. You have some serious leaders who are going on there, and still they're going to revolt again. So because, like I said, Jews just seem to in those days, and I mean, one could argue today, that they have issues with, you know, an authority other than God. You know, it's maybe it's something in our DNA, who knows, but it's definitely something that's there. Yeah, Avi.
Are you going to address when you say Jews, is it very clear as to which section of the Jews was more likely to be pushing the rest of the masses toward that decision to risk what they have?
It's unclear. The rabbis tend to be on these revolts. They tend to be the second ones in on a lot of them. Like, I think Rabbi Akiva was the second one in on Bar Kokhba, but we'll get to that also. Yeah, Lou?
Just want to tie in your other class, your Shabbos class. The Jews have trouble with being ruled by God too.
That's true. The Jews don't like anyone ruling over them. They have trouble being ruled by God also. Although maybe I would say during the first temple they had issues being ruled by God, and during the second temple they had issues being ruled by people, if you wanted to differentiate. And then you could connect it with Chazal. It says the first temple was destroyed because of idolatry, and the second temple was destroyed because of sinas chinam. So, you know, you got it there, yeah.
So how come I don't have any trouble with Obama?
Arthur, that's for time immemorial. Someone's going to be reading listening to this. All right. All right. So we'll start with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who he was and how he took to leadership here. So it's a Gemara in Sukkah, Daf Chav Ches Amud Aleph, talking about where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai comes from, because he's not from Hillel's family. So why is it that he ultimately becomes the leader of the Jewish people in the wake of the destruction of the temple, or even towards the end of the temple period? So the Mishnah in Sukkah says as follows. The Gemara in Sukkah says in follows, 28a. Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis taught, Shmonim tamidim hayulo lehillel hazaken. Hillel had 80 students. Shloshim mehen, 30 of them, ru'uyin tishatishre alehen shchina kemoshe rabbeinu. 30 of them were worthy that the presence of the Lord should rest upon them as it did upon Moses. Ushloshim mehen ru'uyin shetamod lahem chama kiyoshua ben Nun. Right? And the other 30 were worthy that the sun should stand still for them as it did for Joshua. Esrim beinonim. Right, and 20 of them were mid-level people. Okay, Gadol Shebekulan, who was the greatest of all of them. So you would think, you know, who's the only one you've heard of is Yochanan ben Zakkai. You would think that he would be the greatest of them, but not so. Gadol Shebekulan, Yonasan ben Uziel, who's Targum Yonasan. If you see ever seen on the on Chumash and on Navi, so he was the greatest of all of them. Katan Shebekulan, the smallest, so who was number 80 on the list? Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, right? Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was the lowest on the list of the 80. Amru alav al Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, and what did they used to say about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai? Well, so before we say this, so number one is if Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is the lowest on your list, so you have quite an exceptional cadre of Talmidei Chachamim that you have trained if you are Hillel. Hillel has much to be proud of, because again, who knows if there would have been a leadership there to take care of the Jewish people were it not for his inspiration. And again, we spoke about how he came into a system that was breaking down and rebuilt his own system. So what did they used to say about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, number 80 in the shir, right? The guy who was pulling down the gentleman's sea in Hillel's shir, apparently. So what was it? Amru alav Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, shelo hiniach mikra, mishnah, gemara, halachos, agados, dikduke Torah, vikdikduve sofrim, kalim v'chamurim, gzeros shavos, tkuvos gematrios, and sichas malachai ashares, v'sichas shedim, v'sichas dekalim, mishalas kosim, mashalas shualim, davar gadol v'davar katan. Okay, so basically, there was not a pasuk, a mishnah, a gemara, a halacha, a agada, and an inference from the Torah, an inference, a rabbinic inference, simple or serious, a comparison, a various day or time period, a gematria, or the conversations of angels, okay? And so too the conversations of demons, and so too Sichas Dekalim, he could overhear the conversations of the palm trees, all right? Mashalos Kovsin, the parables of washer people, Mashalos Shu'alim, the parables, Aesop's fables about foxes, a great thing and a small thing, and as I like to say, he didn't always drink beer, but when he did, he drank only Dos Equis. Okay, what is a Davar Gadol? What are the great things that he knew? Maisa Merkava, that is Ezekiel's famous vision of some sort of winged chariot. And Davar Katan, what is the simple things that he was able to understand? Havayos de Abaye Virava, the conversations of Abaye Virava, which is kind of amazing since Abaye Virava are 200 years in the future. But I believe it's referring here to Talmudic conversations. As it says in Mishle, to give over my treasures to the next generation. And then the Gemara says, if this is the guy who's pulling down the gentleman's sea, so then, how much more so the greatest of them, Yonasan Beuziel? Amru Alav, so what does it mean to be greater than Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, if he's this kind of legendary and mythical figure who knew, you know, Torah from beginning to end? So they said about Yonasan ben Uziel, B'sha'a sheyoshev osek b'Torah, at the times when he was sitting and learning Torah, kol of sheporeach alav miyad nisraf, right, that if a bird would fly over his head while he was learning Torah, so apparently there was this direct connection between him and God, and that a bird that was flying over his head would immediately be burned to dust. Okay, so first of all, obviously this Gemara is, I don't want to say exaggerating, but I'm sure Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was great, but I think it's making a point that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, so here I'll say it like this, was scholarship alone was not what made Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai the one who was worthy to lead the Jewish people. He was a scholar, you know. Even if you're number 80 in Hillel Shiur, you're still a serious scholar, right? He earned his PhD, shall we say. Okay, that being said, it wasn't that ability that ultimately allowed him to be a great a great leader of the Jewish people. And here's the other interesting fact about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. He wasn't Torasso Umnasso. He wasn't the type of individual who spent all of his time or the entirety of his life learning Torah. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah says as follows, on 31a says as follows, Kol Shnosav Shel Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai Me'av Esrim. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai lived how many years? 120 years, a full life. Mem shana asak bipragmatia. So 40 years he spent what?
Business.
In business, right? He spent as in business. Then mem shana, 40 years he spent learning. And mem shana limeid, in 40 years, his last 40 years, he spent teaching. So what you have in Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is someone who is a bit more worldly in terms of what he was doing, and what ultimately earned him his leadership skills. The Mishnah in Shkalim, before really, I guess the end is near, let's say in the year 66 CE, before that time, it's unclear, we don't hear of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. That being said, we don't hear much about anybody. That's because they were writing down very little. There is one Mishnah, there's a Mishnah in Shkalim, that talks about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai and one of the positions that he took. And I just want to give this, just so you see that he wasn't silent. He wasn't coming out of nowhere. He was someone who had some sort of opinion about the life of the Jewish people and about the culture of the Jewish people in those days. So the Mishnah in the first parak of Shkalim, the fourth Mishnah, says, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Heyed ben Kuvri b'Yavne. So ben Kuvri in Yavne, he bore witness, Shekol Kohen shehu shokel, eino chote. So any Kohen who decides to give the half shekel is not sinning. So they said about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, lo ki ela kol kohen she'eno shokel chote. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's opinion was what? That any Kohen who doesn't give the half shekel, he's the true true sinner. So what was the position that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai took? And again, this is maybe relating very much. Remember, we spoke about last time that Kamtza and Bar Kamtza was kind of like an undercurrent, or speaking of an undercurrent of kind of some sort of cultural tension that's going on here, where you have an upper class, there's a class warfare going on, and the Kohanim were routinely members of the upper class, because again, you would only be able to obtain status in those days in the temple if you were able to pay for it. That's the way it went. So what is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? He's trying to undo whatever special privileges the Kohanim might have had. And what's fascinating is there's very few Kohanim in the leadership of the Jewish people after the destruction of the temple, and it takes a little while before Kohanim come back to rabbinic leadership. And again, a lot of it may have had to do that they were probably going to be part of the assimilated class. They were the wealthy class, they were the assimilated class, they were the class that was probably going to be least loyal to Jewish nationalist pride, since they were the beneficiaries of all that Rome had to offer in those days. Whereas the people on the lower level, the scholars, the farmers, etc., who were probably suffering from taxes and from, you know, tough low class conditions, they're the ones who are probably going to be most eager to join any rebellion against Rome. And so you see here Rav Yochanan being very sensitive to that potential class warfare that's going on there, and insisting that a Kohen who doesn't participate in contributing to the temple, in contributing his machatisa shekel, his half shekel to the temple, so that Kohen is very much a sinner, according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. That being said, the Mishnah does support the Kohanim's claim for exemption, but we know from history that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's halachic opinion is going to carry more weight, let's say, than the opinion of someone even of the stature of Rabbi Yehuda. Where Rabbi Yochanan really bursts onto the scene as a leader and not just merely one other rabbinic voice is during the days of the siege of Jerusalem. One of the things you have to realize is even if you are the great and powerful army that is the Roman Empire, you have to realize that a walled city is not easily conquered in those days. You could send a garrison over the wall, but you would probably lose most of your troops because all it would require were some snipers with their bows and arrows on the top, and you'd probably fairly successfully protect the city. So your only other choice was a battering ram to go through the doors. But they probably had good cedar made doors, and your battering ram probably wasn't going to be successful. At Masada, what do the Romans do? They build a ramp to go up there, but in a city as big as Jerusalem, that probably also would be a risky endeavor because they probably had a large garrison in Jerusalem that could probably hold off during. They'd probably be picking off the various soldiers as they were trying to build the ramp. So your last choice that you have was to starve them out, and it meant a long and drawn out siege. And so the Gemara in Gittin, this is one of those Gemaras that we learn, or that is encouraged to learn on Tisha B'Av, even though it's a day when you're not permitted to be studying Torah. This is one of those things that you're allowed to study. And there it gives at least one version of the story of the destruction of the temple and Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai's rise to power. I want you to take note of a lot of the details because there is a parallel story in Eicha Rabba which has a slightly different perspective on all of it. So let's start with it, the Gemara in Gittin. So the Gemara in Gittin famously says, Shadar Alayhu Leniron Kesar, right? After Kamtza and whole Bar Kamtza, so from Rome, they sent Nero, the Caesar. Kika Ate, when he got there, Shade Giro le Mizrach, he shot a arrow into the east, Asa Nafal b'Yerushalayim. And what happened? The arrow turned, and face towards Jerusalem. What do you do again? Lamarav. He shot one to the west. Asa nafal b'Yerushalayim again. What did it do? It faced towards Jerusalem. He did it l'arba ruchos hashamayim. He did it to all four corners, all four directions. Asa nafal b'Yerushalayim. What did it do? Again, it turned towards Jerusalem. Amar lei liyanuka psok li psukecha. In Talmudic times, there was a fairly common form of predicting what God was saying, which is you would go over to a little kid in the street and ask him, what pasuk did you learn in Cheder today? And you knew what was happening based on what pasuk, what God's message was. So he went over to the closest child and he says, what pasuk are you learning? Amarlei, vinatati es nikmasi be'edom biyad ami Yisrael. So he quotes a pasuk from Ezekiel. Ezekiel was the prophet post-destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, temple number one. And it says, he quotes a pasuk in Ezekiel that says, and I will take my vengeance upon Edom, right? Edom meaning Esav, and Rome was considered, at least in rabbinic literature, the descendant of Esav. And I will take my vengeance upon Edom, biyad ami Yisrael, through the hands of my children, my nation Israel. So Nero says to himself, Kutsha barichu bai lichruve beise, God wants to destroy his house, right? Ubai lichfure yade bahu gavra. And he wants to what? He wants to use me as his vessel to destroy it. He says, Arak v'azel v'igayer. So he left his army, he went and he converted to Judaism. V'nafak minei Rabbi Meir, and his grandson or his great grandson was none other than the famous Rabbi Meir, student of Rabbi Akiva. Okay, so now Rome has a problem. They lost their first general, so they send a second general, Shadre Elihu la'aspisianus Caesar. Right, so this next person who they send is Vespasian Caesar. Atzar tzara lea tlas shani. Right, he sat and he laid siege to the city for 3 years. So havuba, in the city, hanau tlasa atire, there were three wealthy people in the city. Nakdimon ben Gurion was one. Uven kalba savua was the other. Uven tzitzis hakeses. And the third one was Ben Tzitzis HaKeses. And again, here I would point out the historical point of, again, you have the nobility very much taking center stage in this Jerusalem, in the Jerusalem culture. So Nakdimon ben Gurion, right? It's why they call him Nakdimon ben Gurion. Shenakda chama ba'avuro, right? Because the sun would literally stop for him. That's how much money he had, all right? Ben Kalba Savua, why would they call him Ben Kalba Savua? So he says, Savua Shekola Nichnas Leveso Kishihu Ra'ev, because anyone who would go into his house when he was hungry, Ra'ev Kikelev, right? He was hungry as a dog, right? Kalba Yotze Kishihu Saveya, he would leave all full. Kalba Savua. You would be hungry as a dog and leave full. Ben Tzitzis HaKeses, why they call him Ben Tzitzis HaKeses? Shahaisa Tzitzaso Nigreres Agabi Kastos, that what would happen? He was so wealthy, he didn't want his tzitzis to like scrape the ground, so he had special pillows made that he would drag his tzitzis upon. Ika da Amre, others say what? And here again, a very interesting statement. Shahaita Kasto Muteles Ben Gedole Realmi, right? That his pillow or his sofa was planted firmly amongst the nobility of Rome. Okay, just an interesting thing there. So Chadamar, one of them says, Ana Zaina Lehu Bechite Visaare. One says, I will feed all of Jerusalem with chitin and saorim, with wheat and with barley. V'chadamar Lehu B'dechamro D'malcha. The other one says, I will give wine and salt, umashcha and oil, b'chadamar b'detzivi. And the other one says, b'detzivi, which I can't remember what it is, but I forgot what it is at for the moment. It'll come to me a little later. And the rabbi said the tzivi was the best, and I forgot why. Okay. All right, so it seems like Jerusalem's in good shape. Jerusalem's in good shape. They have people to support them. They're doing well. But what happens? Havau behu hanau biryone. Inside Jerusalem, there were these certain zealots. Okay? Amru lehu l'rabbanan, nepuk v'navid shalma behadayu. So the rabbi said to the zealots, let's go make peace with Rome. Let's say we give in, we don't want to fight. Lo shavkinu. They didn't let them. Amru lehu nepuk v'navid krava behadayu. So what did the zealots say? Let's make a krav. Let's fight them. Right? Amru lehu rabbanan, the rabbi said, lo mistaya milsa. So they said, let's make a fight. And the rabbi said to them, it's not going to work. You're going to lose. Right? Look, they're big Rome. We're little Jewish people. We're not going to win. Okay, what are they saying? You know, well, didn't we just celebrate Hanukkah? Right? We won. Right? We can do this. But what's going to happen? The people, they didn't want to fight, nor did they have to fight. They were in a position they didn't have to take a side. So let's just see it here. The rabbis, at least by this Gemara's perspective, the rabbis were the moderates. They were saying, let's make peace with Rome. And then you have these zealots who are saying, let's fight Rome. So it could be that they're the rabbis because the zealots were all killed and the rabbis were the only ones left. So even if there were rabbis amongst the zealots, they're not the ones who are writing the Gemara. So, you know, history is written by the victors, right? So it could be that that's why there weren't any rabbis. And like we said, Josephus makes the claim that Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel had joined the zealots. But Lamaisa, it seems like there's a strong group who were opposing it. But the people don't have to make a decision between the two groups. Why? There's plenty of food, right? There's plenty of food, there's plenty of everything. So the zealots realize if they're going to get anyone on their side, what do they got to do? So what they do? So kamu kalnuhu lahanau ambari dechite usari v'hava kafna. So what they do? They went and they burned down the silos with all the wheat and the barley in it. And what was there? There was a kafna. There was a starvation now in the city, and so much so that Marta bas Baisus, right, who we got to know her also because she was the widow who married a Kohen, who later became the Kohen Gadol because, you know, she pulled some strings on his behalf. So she was one of the wealthy women of Jerusalem. So the Gemara says, she sent her servant out three times to go get her food, first to get white flour, then to get dark flour, and finally to get barley flour. And each time, by the time he got there, it was all gone. And so finally she goes outside and she eats something disgusting from the floor. Unclear what it is that she eats from the floor, but she eats something disgusting from the floor. Possibly one of Rabbi Tzadok, who was we'll get to him, who was fasting. She eats it and she dies. And the Gemara talks about how terrible that was. I'm skipping down here now to the paragraph that starts Abba, which is right on the bottom of page one. And obviously you're seeing the time. I'm not going to make it much farther, but Abba, I want to finish at least this story. Abra Sikra Reish Biryone de Yerushalayim. Abra Sikra was the head of the zealots. He also happened to be Bar Achde de Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He also happened to be the nephew of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. And he sends him a letter. Ava Shalach Le Tabitzina Lagabai. So he sends message to Abba Sikra, come meet me privately. Asa, and he comes. Amar le at emat avidutu hachi v'katiltu le la'alma b'kafna. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says to Abba Sikra, how long will you kill the people of the Jewish people through starvation? You know, we're starving here. What's going on? Amar le mayavid. Right? What should I do? Di'i amina lehu midi kadlu. If I try to change people's mind and say, let's give in, they're just going to kill me. So Amar le Chazi li takanta li didi de epok efshar dahave yatzala porta. So Rabbi Yochanan now makes the bold statement. He says, get me out of the city, and maybe I can do something to save everybody. Amale nakot nafshecha b'ktzirei, v'leisi kulei amo v'lishai lubach. So Abba Sikra suggests to Rabbi Yochanan that he do as follows. Tell everybody that you're sick, and have everyone come and visit you and see how you're sitting. V'aisi midei sarya v'agnei gabach, v'leimru dinach nafshach. And after a while, find your closest students, and what? Have them surround you, and say, dinach nafshach, that you died. Fake your own death. V'leyai lubach tamidach, v'lo leo bach inesh achrina, d'lo rakshan bach d'kalil at, d'inhu yadei d'chaya kalil mimesa. And what should you have? Have only your students carry your deathbed, your coffin. Why? Because everybody knows that dead people weigh more, or at least feel as if they weigh more than live people. And he says, and what's going on? Hold on. Nichnas bo Rabbi Eliezer mitzad echad, Rabbi Yeshua mitzad acher. So who'd they have? He had his two closest students, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Remember those names because they'll come up a lot as we go through the history. So kimatu lepitcha. So when they get to the doorway of Jerusalem, you weren't allowed to bury people in Jerusalem. So they wanted to go take him out. Kimatu lepitchu bo lemitkare. So what did they want to do when they got to the doorway? They wanted to stab him to make sure he's dead. Amar lehu yomru rabban dakru. Right? What they're going to say? They're going to say, look at these people. What they do? They stabbed their own rabbi. We're going to go out to the Romans. What are they going to think of us, right? What would the Goyim say, right, if we stab him? So bow the mitchafe. So they wanted to slap him around a little bit and make sure he's really dead. Yeah, so he says, you're going to bruise him up, and yomru rabban dachvu, right? They're going to say, what are you going to do? They're going to say they beat up their rabbi. So what does he say? Patchule baba and nafak. They opened up the door, and they left. So fine. So apparently, he's able to get to see Vespasian. Kimasta lahasam. When he got there, Amar Shlomo alach Malka, Shlomo alach Malka. When he got there, he says, "Hello, my king. Hello, my king." So says Vespasian. Amar lei mechayev estrei katla. You're required to be killed for two reasons. Reason number one, chada delav Malka ana. Number one, you should be killed because I'm not the king. Vikara risli malka, and you're calling me the king. You know, that is, you know, grounds for being killed. Vitu, and secondly, imalka ana, if I'm king, ad haidna my loasis legabai, so then I'm insulted. If I'm really the king, you should have come to me earlier to tell me this. So now I'm upset with you. So Amar Le, so Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai responds to him, Dika amarta lav malka ana, ibra malka at. He says, that which you say to me that you're not the king, impossible. In truth, you must really be the king. Right? It's impossible. I see that Jerusalem is going to fall. I know it. I've been inside there. There's starvation there. Jerusalem's going to fall. If you are not the king, then it's impossible that Jerusalem would fall in your hands. Right? As it says, and the Lebanon, meaning here referring to that built with the Lebanese cedars, will fall by the great hand. The in Adir El Melech, the great hand could only be the king. Etc. The in Lebanon El Beis HaMikdash, the Lebanon can only be the Beis HaMikdash. Right? As it says in Devarim, Haharatel Hazeb Halavanon. Right, Moshe wanted to see the good mountain and the Levanon, meaning referring to that. Udika Marta, and that which you said, Imalka ana amayloka asis legabai. And that which you said, if I am the king, why did you not come to me? So he says, Ad haidna, until now, biryoni de isban lo shavkinan. Right, he says, until now, the biryone, the zealots in the city, would not allow me to get out until this point. So Amar Lei, he says to him, so now Vespasian is going to play the game with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Ilu chavish shel dvash v'darkon karuch aleha lo ayushover nesachavish b'shvil darkon. Vespasian says to him, listen, if you have a barrel and it's surrounded by a snake. Okay? A deadly snake. So he says, wouldn't you, you know, to kill the snake, sometimes you got to break the barrel. What's he saying to him? He said, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was implying to Vespasian, listen, it's a small group of annoying people who have usurped leadership and are, you know, controlling everyone and forcing this this rebellion. Okay? So, you know, don't blame me. And Vespasian saying, listen, what am I supposed to do? I got to kill the snake. And I can't kill the snake without breaking the barrel. And it says that Ishtik, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai did not respond. Rav Yosef was very upset about this. Karalai Rav Yosef, Item Rabbi Akiva, some say it was Rabbi Akiva who was very upset about it. Why? Meshiv Chachamim Achor, V'da'atam Yisachel. What does he do? God pulls the wise men back and he confuses or he makes foolish their knowledge. Right? He makes foolish their knowledge. Why? He says, Yibayle Lameimar Shaklina Tzavla. You take a stick, v'shaklinan ledarkon, v'tekatlinan le, v'chavita shavkinan la. Right? What do? You do a surgical strike. Right? You don't destroy the barrel. That's what he should have said. Adahachi, they're sitting there talking. At parsitka alemi romi, comes along a messenger from Rome. Amarle, kum, get up. It says to Vespasian, arise. Dimitle Caesar, because Caesar has died. Va'amri hanau chashivi de Romi, right? Rome was an oligarchy. They have appointed you, the elders of Rome have appointed you la'otviche bereshe. You're now the Caesar. You're now the Caesar. Congratulations, Vespasian. So, sure enough, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was 100% correct. Havasim chad mesanei bar le mesai malachrina. So he had put on one boot and he wanted to put on the other boot. Lo ayo. Right? It didn't work. He couldn't put on his other boot. So bar le mishlef al idach. So he wanted to pull off the one that was on the foot that he had. Lo nafak. It wouldn't come off. Amar my high. So he says, what the heck is going on here? So Amar le, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, lo titzdayer shmua tova asya lecha. He says, don't worry. Don't get upset about what's going on here. Whenever you get very good news, you must have gotten good news. Dichsiv shmua tova dajayetzen, because it's a pasuk. The pasuk says good news makes your limbs swell, right? Or your bones swell. Ala maita kante. So Vespasian says, what should I do to make it better? Leise inish delo miatva datach mimenu. Go find some guy who you really don't like. Bring him before you. V'lachliv kamach, let him come before you. V'dichtiv ruach nechat yabish gerim. Right, as it says, right, when you have a depressed soul or a depressed spirit, your bones dry up. And what happens? Avad hachi ayo. And sure enough, he brought in front of him someone who he disliked. And it worked. So now Vespasian looks at Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai and says, Amar le, he says to him, Me'achar dechach misu kule hai. Since you're such a smarty pants, Ad ha'idna amai lo asisu l'gabai. He says, why have you not come to me until this very moment? Amar le, v'lo amar li, amri lach, amri, so he says, I told you already. They're biryone, they kept me out. Amar le, ananami amri lach. I says, I told you also. What should you have done? You should have killed all the biryone. But he didn't say it. Amar le, meze alzina v'inish achrina mishadarna. So what does Vespasian says now? He says, I got to go back to Rome to rule. So someone else is going to take over for me. Ella bai minai midi de tenlecha. So he says, ask for me something, and I will give it to you. So he says, Amar le tenli yavne v'chachameha. He asks for Yavne and its wise men. V'shol shilta de Rabban Gamliel. And I want also the family of Rabban Gamliel. We said that's Hillel's family. And he says, also, V'asvata de Masyan the Rabbi Tzadok. And I want doctors to help cure Rabbi Tzadok. If you remember from the last year, Rabbi Tzadok was the one who said in the Gemara in Yuma, after you had that case where one Kohen killed another, right, over the Avodah, Rabbi Tzadok was the one who stood up there and said, you know, we got blood on our hands, everybody. Rabbi Tzadok seems to be the one, symbolically or and actually, who is standing up and saying already earlier than everyone else, I see the writing on the wall, and we're in big trouble. And if we don't do something, we're in major trouble. And so what he was doing was he was fasting every day that the Beis HaMikdash shouldn't be destroyed. And so he asks for it. He asks for doctors to cure him. Rav Yosef, and some say Rabbi Akiva, get very upset. Because what should Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai have asked for? Leave us alone. Come back another time. Let us deal with these zealots. And then it would be fine. And then the answer that they give is that he thought Vespasian would never agree to that. So let's just see what comes out of this Gemara. What comes out of this Gemara is Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai is a known leader of the Jewish people. He is part of a rabbinic group that is protesting the revolt against Rome. And he is snuck out of Jerusalem, and he is given a kind of, he serves as an ambassador for the Jewish people. And he, instead of asking for Jerusalem, he chooses to start building anew or planning for what's going to happen post-war, because he sees the writing on the wall in terms of this loss. Just quickly, we'll do the parallel in Eicha Rabbah, which it's in really rough Aramaic. But in Eicha Rabbah, I brought you also here the English. Eicha Rabbah, Parsha Aleph, Halacha Lamed Aleph. So it has a very similar story, where Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is able to sneak out of the city, but he does not meet Vespasian till much later on when he's kind of living amongst all these refugees. Okay, we'll read it in the English. We're up against it for the time. Upon leaving the gates, they carried him to a certain cemetery and returned to the city. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai then went forth and walked among Vespasian's soldiers. He asked them, "Where is the king?" They answered, "Let him approach." When he drew near, he greeted them, "Viva Domini Imperator." He replied, "You hail me as king, but I am not king, and when the king hears of this, he will put me to death." Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai replied, "If you are not king now, you will be in the future, for this temple will be destroyed by no one other than a king." 3 days later, Vespasian went to bathe in Gophna, which is north of Jerusalem. When he had bathed and put on one of his boots, a messenger came to announce that Nero was dead and that the Romans had elected Vespasian his successor. He wanted to put on his other boot, but it would not go on. So he sent for Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who said, "You have received good news." Vespasian asked, "What shall I do to make the boot fit?" He replied, "Is there anyone who you hate, who has done wrong? Let him pass in front of you and it will shrink." Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai said, "Make me a request and I shall grant it." He said, "I asked you to abandon the city of Jerusalem and leave." So in this story, what does he ask him for? He asks him for Jerusalem. Said he, "Is it for that the Romans made me king? Make a different request." Then Rav Yochanan said, "I ask you to withdraw from the western gate of Jerusalem that faces towards Lida, so whoever leaves before the third hour may be saved." What does he ask for? The western? The Kotel, right? He asked for the Kotel. Okay, so just an interesting different perspective. What I want you to get here is Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is making an uncommonly bold decision here. He, during the war, he is beginning to plan, according to both stories, he is beginning to plan for how to deal with life in the wake of a defeat. He sees the writing on the wall. He's making an uncommonly bold decision. And again, I would argue that it was a decision he was prepared for by Hillel and Hillel's children. What was Hillel's goal? Hillel says, in the wake of the loss of a Sanhedrin, in the wake of the loss of our normative practice of how we decide halacha, we have to decide, or we have to begin to create a new system that is going to be successful. If it means, you know, revealing the system of Torah Shebaal Peh to everyone in order for them to be able to deal with it, so great. If it's something else, so we'll deal with that. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai sees that God wants to destroy his temple. He sees that this is the way it's happening, so he begins to make the plans for a new type of existence. Okay, this is his very, very bold decision, and this is why he gets he is kind of thrust into the leadership here. He's not from Hillel's family. And again, you know, we could deal with all the theories that Rabban Gamliel was being hidden in order to protect him, because even though he has the guarantee, let's say, from Vespasian, that he's not going to destroy Rabban Gamliel's family, we all know how much that guarantee is worth, especially if you have a group of Jews who can't just seem to accept the fact that they're not in charge anymore. Okay, so that's what's going on there. So just so if we had to summarize our first kind of step into the world of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is the individual who is able to make the hard and difficult decisions. He's able to make them boldly. We'll find out if he has any regrets towards the end of his life. You know, that's definitely something we're going to have to discuss. But he is looking towards a future without the temple, or at least a future after a massive loss to Rome, and he's looking to rebuild. What's the city he wants? I want Yavne and Chachameha. He wants out of the Merkaz, out of the center of the city, moving towards the coast, right? Where Yavne is, you know, Yavne is right outside Tel Aviv, right? It's what is it? It's south. No, it's just south of Tel Aviv, just northwest of Jerusalem, right?
West
of Jerusalem, straight out west of Jerusalem. But he wants out of the Merkaz. He understands that there is going to be a massive transitionary period heading on for the Jewish people, and he makes an uncommonly bold decision, and that's who Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai is. Someone who makes bold decisions. Also, interestingly enough, he's non-confrontational. He could have, I mean, one could potentially view him as leading a counter-revolution or a pro-Roman insurgency within Jerusalem. Right? He might have said, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Eliezer, let's gather up a band of guys, let's knock off the Biryone, the zealots, right? Let's hand over their bodies to the Romans, and the Romans will leave us this time. He did not. He's non-confrontational. And again, he tends to be very, very much a moderate in terms of his leadership qualities. Okay, that's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Yeah.
Is he halakhically a moderate?
We'll talk about it. Yeah.
What's the legacy of Yavne? How long did it last?
Yavne is, that's the next 70, 80 years of Jewish history.
So.
Yeah. Yavne is going to be a big deal. Yavne is going to be the place until Rav Yehuda Hanasi moves it to the north of Israel, where ultimately they publish the Mishnah. Yeah, Avi? Ich weiß nicht.
Cool, good.
Thank you. Yeah.
But the people or the rabbis at that time associate Rome with Edom.
Yeah, it seems like Rome's been associated with Edom for a long, long period of time.
From this portion.
Yeah, Yaft Elokim Yafet Vishkom Reelai Shem. Yeah.
The blessings of.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think it caused one of Esav's children is called Romi. I think also. So I think. It's been a long time. Jerry, yeah.
So with the fall of the temple, it's the fall of the Kohanim.
Yeah, yeah. The Kohanim lose their... Although, one of the interesting things is you're going to see there is some... There are going to continue giving Trumos and Masros to the Kohanim even after the fall of the temple. They'll still get their special gifts for the Kohanim. Bechoros they'll get. You know, there will be things that go to the Kohanim.
Would it be fair to call Yochanan a collaborator? I mean, that's what it sounds like to me.
Or a savior.
Well, it depends on which perspective you're looking at.
Yeah. If you know you're going to lose, don't hit your head against the wall.
Yeah, that's you say that about World War II, Patan, and all the rest of it.
Don't.
I don't know.
Hard to say. His life is a complicated existence. Chazal, generally, he was judged by rabbinic literature very, very positively. But we'll see something. We'll see his deathbed is recorded in the Talmud, and it's a very complicated story. It's a very complicated story, so just wait for next week to find out.